Hello, amazing parents and caretakers, and welcome to the Pumped Up Parenting Podcast. I'm your family empowerment coach, Celia Kibler. I'm a mom of a blended family of five kids. I'm a grandma of nine kids, an author, a teacher, a speaker, and a consultant with over 40 years of training and real-life parenting experience. I'm here to offer you practical, doable tips, strategies, and techniques that will pump up your parenting skills and create peace, love, and laughter throughout your family. In addition, I'll be interviewing some great humans that are on a mission to make your life a better, happier, and healthier life. So let's not waste any time and get started with the next episode of the Pumped Up Parenting Podcast. Thanks for listening. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Pumped Up Parenting Podcast. Get ready because this is going to be a great podcast. I am super thrilled to have my guest here today. Meet Tate Barkley. He is the author of Sunday Dinners, Moonshine and Men, soon to be out September 25th. He is an accomplished attorney, speaker, and educator, and I'm thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome, Tate.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, I am thrilled to have you and excited to dive into this. And if you would, please tell our listeners background on what brought you to this book. You can reach Tate at tatebarkley.com. You can reach him on Instagram at barkley.tate. I hope that's correct.
Right.
And he's on Facebook all over the place. And at the end of this conversation that you're going to love, you'll find out that you can get his book on Amazon, some other locations, but we'll talk more about your story. So let's get started. I like your book name, Sunday Dinners, Moonshine and Men. Just so you're a successful attorney, you're gay, what you lived through. People don't realize people's journeys that feel like, you know, you're not supposed to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. If you're not supposed to talk about these things, you're not supposed to talk about them. So why are we talking about them, you know?
See, and if you want to get into that, you're welcome to, but that's how we were raised. That's how we were from small town South, and we came from very conservative churches, and you did not, as my Ma Barkley would say, you didn't air dirty laundry. You didn't talk about those things. And my mother struggled with it. My dad for sure struggled with it. I struggled with it. It took a lot to get me to, really the loss of everything to get me sober and to get me being honest about my feelings. And
you probably drank due to it, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, good Lord. Yes, absolutely.
How did you wind up telling your family?
Well, for me, I did it in stages. I was 28 years old when I first started coming out. So I was a little late to the coming out process. And the first people I began to tell were my closest friends. And, you know, fortunately for me, my closest friends, everything was fine. And I was most nervous about my guy friends. And, you know, I can give you an example. One of my really good guy friends, his name was John. And here was kind of the typical thing that I got from my straight guy friends. Most of them said, hey, you know, Tate, you know, you're my friend. I love you. And we're still going to be friends. And if that's who you are, that's who you are. Then there would be this long pause and they would go, were you ever attracted to me? And usually the answer was no, I wasn't attracted to you. And then there'd be this long pause and they'd go, like, why not? So it was such a loaded question. But I got to just stick
with it. What's wrong with me? I'm pretty cool. Right. I'm a cool guy.
I don't have to say you're a good looking guy. No, don't get me wrong. It was a thing to work through that with my straight guy friends.
That is really funny. Funny, as soon as you said that, I thought to myself, they probably were like, well, why aren't you why? What's wrong with me?
Why'd you not do it on me?
Right, exactly.
So,
It's very funny. So how long were you, did you become an attorney prior to coming out, or like, was that your profession right out of school, being an attorney?
You know, my progression was, I was still closeted while I was in college and in law school. And I passed the Texas bar exam in 1991. And about a year with a firm, I went out on my own with a buddy from law school, and we started a firm. I was practicing for about 2 years when I came out. So I was a practicing attorney when I came out. And one of the great worries I had when I came out was, you know, it is Texas in the early 90s, and it's not like this is a liberal utopia down here. So I was very worried about losing clients, because mm-hmm. I was on my own by then. And I was afraid that my referral sources and my clients, once they learned I was gay, that there would be some judgment attached to it and that I would start losing money. And that was really, a big worry for me. I came from a childhood of instability, housing instability, and poverty. And so money was a big deal to me. And I was always afraid. I never wanted to be poor again. I just never wanted to go back to that life we had for so many years when I was young. So it was a big fear for me. But I knew that I had to do it. So as I started coming out to my friends, I came out to my colleagues. And then in time, I didn't send them, you know, a letter out to all my clients saying, hey, right. I'm gay. Right. You know, but if they asked, I told the truth, though, you know, and because, you know, and so, but the fact of the matter is, the biggest worry was the people that were referring cases to me. You know, there were doctors and other attorneys that referred cases to me that they didn't necessarily handle, that weren't in their wheelhouse. I did a lot of personal injury and civil rights work, and that was what I was worried about. But I had a good experience there, too. A couple of referral sources did dry up. Some folks that were a little narrow-minded, but I didn't notice it a lot, you know, in terms of financially. The toughest thing I had, you know, and then in time, I have four sisters, and in time I came out to each of my sisters. I think the biggest shock to me in the process is that my younger sisters, all of them had the same reaction, which was, we knew you were gay. I was gay. It's not like I, you know, told anybody. They said, we just knew. When I was 16, I had a friend of mine who was my first love. His name was Rob. And he would come over to the house. And I don't know, you know, sisters are intuitive. And they figure stuff out. One of my sisters was Carrie Tate, you know, and she wrote me this long letter. And I remember, and it was just before I started coming out to everybody, and she had already graduated, you know, college by then. And she wrote me this long letter about how she loved me. And you can tell me anything, and I'm not going to pass judgment on you. And it was this beautiful, sweet, wonderful letter. And she's literally trying to say, look, just get it over with, please. Quit tormenting yourself and the rest of us. You can tell us anything, underline.
Right. And I think for a lot, it's things like that. It is ourselves building it up. We create these monsters inside us when we don't let it out. You know, when it builds up and we keep creating this story that may or may not, and usually isn't, true. And it's all living inside us. So when we finally talk to someone and they're like, your sister is, you know, that's just like, how did your parents respond?
Well, the dynamic with my parents was a little different. They were very small town South. And so much of the book is really, you know, it's really a memoir about my relationship with my dad and I. My dad was one of those hyper-masculine, larger-than-life kind of men. He was a heavy drinker. He could be violent when he was drinking. Our family dynamic was very delicate. And then, you know, mom had to account for that. I was a little later. I was 30 when I came out to mom. And when I told my mom, she started crying. And this was what was surprising to me. She says, you know, your dad and I talked about this when you were in high school. Because I did have a friend who was, you know, a little flamboyant. And my dad would ask about it. But, you know, my protection from that was, look, I did a lot of speech and debate. So I'm kind of the speech and debate crowd. But I also hang out with the drama crowd. And I always say, Dad, he's in drama, you know. And
that explains it.
So he would stop asking and not drill down any further.
He's a theater guy. Okay, right. Understand.
You know, so let's just not talk about that, because, you know, he was gay. And he was, and my mom said, you know, she said, son, I'll just have to deal with it in my own way. I had always thought that, because I was so close to my baby sisters, and when I was young, I'd go around and tell you, I want to have 7 kids because I love my
sisters.
Were
you the oldest of the 5 or 6?
Yeah. Yes.
You're the oldest. 5.
So, and then she said, but I mean, you're my son. I love you. And I'll just need time with this. And then I said, should I tell Dad? And we fell into that old dynamic of how much chaos is that going to create for the rest of the family? Because that's how we lived. I mean,
right.
My dad could be a very stern disciplinarian toward me as a male, and it could get physical. I don't think, you know, he never like hit me in the face, but he was physically violent towards my mom a number of times. So we had to account. We had to deal with that in the family dynamic. And so we basically concluded not to tell Dad then. And the book really revolves around my struggle, even once I got sober, of when do I tell Dad? And then one of the things I learned, and Sia, you already picked up on this, you've already said it. By the time I got around to talking with my dad, I realized that it was me who was holding all this shame.
Yep.
You know, and I fundamentally believe I got sober. My dad and I shared one thing in common. We did not have a good relationship until we became drinking buddies. But once I got older and we became drinking buddies, we were like best friends. We'd romp and tear and go on road trips and shoot pool and do all these things. And then when I got sober in 99, you know, he picked me up at the airport drunk. I just flew home from Hazelden, which is a recovery place up in Minnesota. And he kept saying, well, did they teach you how to drink up there? And I said, no, Dad, they did not teach me how to drink. I'm an alcoholic. I can't drink. And Dad and I had this friction because he had lost a drinking buddy. And I think Dad was intuitive enough to know the significance of what had just happened. He had lost his best friend and best drinking buddy, because the booze helped me tamp down all those issues I had towards Dad. I had intense resentments towards Dad because of the way he treated us, and particularly the way he treated Mom. And I had resentments, I'll be honest, against my mom, I love and who did everything in the world for us. And that resentment wasn't because she didn't do everything in the world for her. It's just that so many times I wanted to stand up to Dad and tell him what a jerk he was. And I wanted to confront him and let him know that this is not right, how he was treating us and certainly how he was treating her. And she would never let me. Her job was to keep the peace. And
right.
So it wouldn't get worse.
That's and what happens adult, when people are treated like that.
Yeah. And as an adult, I get that now. As a sober man, I get that now. But at the time, I was like, I resented the fact that I couldn't stand up to him because that would have created such chaos. So one of the things that Sunday Dinners, Moonshine and Men did for me is I didn't start out to write a book. my dad died in 2012, and the first words of this book were written in 2013, and I was still trying to reconcile all these feelings I had about my father, who was now deceased, you know, and how I felt about him. And I felt a little disingenuous at the time, so to be honest with you. I had worked my program of recovery. I believe in the 12 steps. That's how I got sober, was AA. And you do the work and you do the writing, the fourth step and the fifth step, you know. And if you would have asked me, I would have said, yes, I've forgiven everybody, I'm good. But I got to tell you, it wasn't until I started writing and writing and writing that I realized that was not true. I still held so much upset and confusion and disappointment with my relationship with my dad, who was the single biggest influence on my life.
Absolutely. They tend to be.
And the beauty of this book has been this. The gift of this book has been this. I can say honestly now that the journey of writing this book, I have forgiven my dad and I have forgiven my mom.
That's so great.
I'm 58 years old now. It took a while to get here. You know,
it does. It takes a while. It's like you go through, you know, it's like part of my mission with, you know, stopping parents from yelling at their kids and being so aggressive is like my dad was very, you know, the old walking on eggshells. You never knew what was going to trigger them. Right. And my mother was very protective of that. Because she wanted, like your mom, she wanted to keep the peace. You know, people that are raised or that are partnered with aggressive, screaming, you know, raging adults, those people either come out like that, raging and screaming and aggressive, or they come out as the peacemaker and they have to keep the calm. I came out as a peacemaker. My siblings came out more like in your face, dad. You're yelling at me, I'm yelling at you. Never did I ever do that. I just walked away. And, but it's like, I would hear my dad call my mom stupid, idiot, things like that. Never called me that, but I took it to heart. It took me probably till my mid-50s, now I'm 65, to recognize that I'm not stupid. I used to consider myself the stupidest one in that family. I was amongst genius, and literally geniuses lived in my family. Me was not one of them. And so I just considered myself so stupid, but you know, we're all genius at different levels and it takes a long time. But once you can forgive, forgiveness is for you, of course, and to relieve yourself of that, you know, guilt, that constant focus on the other party, you know, releasing that and releasing that disappointment and all that sadness that you have inside of you. But it takes a while, you know, it truly takes a while. And I love, you know, the writing and the book. I haven't read it yet. I can't wait to read, and I will probably be one of your first customers. But like, it's just so great when you read a book that takes you on a journey like that to find, you know, who you are, your identity, and feel confident in who you are. Because we lose that confidence with all that aggressive parenting and all that judgment and all that criticism. That's what people don't speak up, and they second guess themselves because they're not confident enough in what they say. Hey parents, it's Celia. Just want to take a break from this podcast for a moment. You know, I get it. Life gets hard, things get chaotic, kids can get out of hand, and you start yelling. And I know you feel bad about it. What if I told you that in 21 days, yes, 21 days, you could stop yelling? How? Because I have a new program out, 21 Days to Stop Yelling at Your Kids, and you will get an email every day for 21 days with instructions of a system that you can put into place so you become a proactive parent and stop being a reactive parent. Are you ready for that? Can you imagine life in just 21 days? What if you don't do it? What will life be in 21 days? A lot of the same or even worse? So go to quityelling.com, quityelling.com, and get it at an introductory price, super low, super affordable, so that you can finally stop yelling at your kids and realize how cooperative your kids can be and how much listening and smiles can go on day after day. Go to quityelling.com. Now back to our podcast. Tell me more about Sunday dinners. Like, the first part of your title is Sunday dinners.
Yeah, Sunday dinners, where that comes from, when I was little, and I think, you know, we had a tremendous amount of instability when I was little. And it was as I've shared, my dad, you know, he was a yeller too, whenever the time came for it. But then when I was very, very young, we went to church. We were still in North Carolina. And I started in Statesville, which is sort of small town south. And my grandmother Kirkman, we would go to church with her every Sunday. And being with her and coming home from church was my favorite time of the week, because she would always make Sunday dinner. And she would always have me in the kitchen with her. She never pushed me away or shooed me away because I was getting in the way, though I was. And she would always keep me with her. And she would talk and she would sing. And she was very religious. And it would be like, let's sing Amazing Grace. And she would pound the cube steak and sing Amazing Grace out loud. And then she'd pop in the cobbler. And it was so neat hanging out with her on Sunday. And then we'd have this big dinner, because I love to eat. I still love to eat.
Me too. I'm with you.
And she made the best Sunday dinner. And she was my safe place. And that day and that event of making and eating Sunday dinner was my favorite time. So, you know, the Sunday dinner portion of the book really signifies for me that safe place I identified in what turned out to be a really chaotic and really frightful in some instances childhood. I did have a safe place and a safe person, and that was my grandmother. And it was in the kitchen with her, singing and cooking and eating. And I was very young. And as I grew up, I didn't like going to church, but I always liked going to church with her. You know, that's just how it was. So the Sunday dinners is really where I talk about my childhood in the book. And it is the symbolism is with my grandmother Kirkman and those times I used to spend with her, because the other 6 days of the week weren't near as great. So it was always my favorite time to be with her.
Great.
Grandmothers are
that.
A big deal.
Yeah, they are. They are. And being a grandma, I think it's a very big deal. I love having grandchildren. I love the relationship I have with my grandchildren. You know, it's a special time. It's really, really quite wonderful. And it's great that you have those memories. That's just like, that's what it's all about, is those, you know, childhood memories and remembering all the good. Because you could spend your time remembering all the negative. You could spend your time dwelling on all the things that, you know, hurt you and that were horrible to live through, or you could spend your time dwelling on what was great and living a life learning from what went on in your past and growing from that instead of like dwelling on it. So it's good that such a positive thing starts the name of your book. That's really wonderful. How early did you know you were gay? And how long did it take you to feel comfortable enough in your skin and to avoid and just face the music before you actually came and decided, I'm telling my first friend?
You know, I think the first time that I knew that I was attracted to other guys, I don't think I would acknowledge that I was gay or anything, but the first time I really knew that I was attracted to guys was probably when I was about 12, around sixth grade. And I had a best friend, and we met at the bus stop, sixth grade. We played football. We were in rural North Carolina, and that's what boys did. You had to play football and basketball. And we became very, very, very close. And we were in that curious time, exploratory time. And as the year progressed, he and I spent a lot of time together. So he was kind of obsessed with girls, and I got my first girlfriend, and he was more excited about me having my first girlfriend than I was, you know. You know, I didn't think in terms of you better check the box, but I'm thought, well, aren't boys supposed to have girlfriends?
Right.
And I'm all, you know, so I figured I better get me one. And but as we approached the summer after my sixth grade year, we started talking more and more about it, and we began touching each other and roughhousing a little more, and the touches would linger. And so we there was a game called odd and even. So you flip and say, okay, heads or tails kind of game is what it was like, odd or even. And whoever won the most coins out of the nine, you know, had to could give the other person a dare. And it was through that process, he and I began exploring each other. And we knew, and we began a physical exploration with each other. I don't know if you could call it sex. It wasn't really sex as we understand it, but it was really a really sort of innocent and sweet exploration with one another. He was my best friend. I trusted him, and he trusted me. So I think that's when I knew. And we both were raised in the same ways. We both had very hyper-masculine dads. We were in rural North Carolina. We knew the expectations of us. And I remember he lived in a mobile home up on a dirt road. So we were walking up the dirt road that summer. We used to run around in the woods and shoot the BB gun and do stuff like that. And when I was walking him home, he put his arm around me. And he said, is what we do homosexual? And at that moment, I became really afraid, because I knew it had changed. The minute it got designated or categorized as something like that, it was something that was going to be bad. And the minute he asked that question, I knew we wouldn't be doing it anymore. And I tried to push it off. I said, no, homosexuals do these things. And I knew I wasn't quite telling the truth. And he said, good, because, you know, we can't do that. God will not allow for us to do that. And I said, I know. And that's kind of when it changed. But soon thereafter, my dad made the proclamation that we were going to Texas. He sat me on the concrete steps of our trailer. We lived in a trailer too, out on this farm road. And he said, Bubba, that was my family name, Bubba. He said, Bubba, he says, we're leaving. He says, we're going to Houston, Texas. And I looked up at him and I said, Texas? And he said, yes. He says, Houston's booming. It's booming out there, Bubba. And he says, I'm telling you right now, all things are possible if we go to Texas. And I would, and my dad made decisions fast. 3 days later, we were all piled up in a car heading to Houston, Texas. And we hardly said goodbye. See, it was only later I learned, well, really later in that day I learned, when he went up to pick up his last check, that there were, he had a warrant out for his arrest. So we went
to Texas
for a couple of reasons.
More than just to go find your future.
So we weren't just going to build our future. Right. We were fleeing our past.
Right. In a big, fast way. Are you and that friend of yours, are you still friends? Are you still in contact with each other?
We have communicated with one another off and on. I can share this, that when I came out, he was on my mind. And I still had, at the time, I still had kin people that I kept in touch with. We were in, you know, we were in Texas by this time. You know, we left in 1977. So, and this is in the early 90s. So I went back to North Carolina and I looked him up, and he and I spent the day together and we talked about it.
That's great.
He was married, and I told him, I said, I was honest with him that I had come out and that I was gay and all of that. And I said, I sure hope you don't think that I sure hope you don't regret what happened, is what I told him. Because, you know, he said, no, I'm straight and I built my life this way. And I said, well, I sure hope you don't regret what happened. And you know what he said? He said, you know what? He says, you were my best friend. And I loved you. And I knew you loved me. And we were kids. And he says, I don't regret one minute of it. So don't worry about
right.
that. It took a huge load. I mean, I started crying and he teared up.
I'm sure he did.
It just took a huge load off both of us.
Mm-hmm.
So we could look back at that best friend relationship we had at the time and it be the good, wonderful thing it was. And that was really a gift, you know. And
so great.
I think I learned from that, Celia, that we're afraid of certain conversations with people because we don't know what's going to happen. But man, as I've gone through the process over these years, those conversations, they're just essential.
Yes, they are. It's amazing what conversation can resolve and how much we avoid it because we're assuming what the other is thinking. And, you know, even with my clients, and I work with families, I work with couples. And one of the things I tell every single client of mine is none of us are mind readers. You cannot assume what the other's thinking because your assumption will probably, for the most part, be wrong. You have to ask. It's like when couples say, you know, to the other, they don't do something because they're like, you know, people say all the time, they should know. And I'm always like, why should they know? Did you ask them? Did you tell why? And they say it all. Why don't they just know? They should know. No, actually, they shouldn't know. Unless you just speak up and ask them to do something or share a thought with them or ask them how they're feeling. Because then you get the truth, not your truth. You get the truth from them. And that will go to the next level. That will resolve. That might not be what you want to hear. You know, it can go either way.
Sure.
But you can either spend your life guessing or you can step up to the plate and just ask and
you know,
speak
and
up.
Yeah, and I'll speak for myself, but I can tell you this, and others may share the same affliction, I don't know. But when I allow the little committee in my head to be the only people in the conversation, it is amazing the erroneous conclusions that
right.
I draw about the most basic things.
Exactly, exactly. Exactly. Those little voices that were put there when you were a child.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, or I'll even say to people when they'll bring up something, well, you know, this person judged me a certain way. And maybe it's a teacher in school or something like that. And I'm like, what level of importance does that person hold in your life right now? That teacher that you're still listening to. Over 30 years, have you seen them? Do you know anything about them? You're letting them hold all this space in your mind and within your character. And who are they? Sometimes we let these strangest people take hold of our beliefs, you know, and we have to really examine the committee. I love that you said that, the committee that we've elected. In our brains. You might have to get rid of some. You have to retire some. Term limits. We
term
need term limits.
Right.
Let's not bring this to a government conversation, but We need term limits, even with the committee in our brains.
Yeah, the committee in my head. Oh my gosh.
We need to go through and resign a few of them. So let me ask you, so Tate, are you married? Are you in a committed relationship right now?
Yes,
you are married.
I am married.
How has that been good for, are there any children involved? Like, or is it just you guys?
Yeah, we married in 2017. Anson and I married in 2017. And our sole child is a King Charles Cavalier named Emerson, who dominates the house. So,
of course.
So we serve him.
You need my help. I help even with dogs.
Okay, good. Oh my God, good.
I have many people who follow me and go, you know, I actually don't have any children. I have a dog, but you're so helpful. Your advice is so helpful.
So when we're not serving Emerson,
right?
Our King Charles, I practice law and we kid a lot. My husband kids me. He is a developmental and behavioral pediatrician. So certainly deals. What he says is, my patients, the kids with autism and ADHD and all these other things, he says they're a delight. The parents, on the other hand, right. Oh my God.
So true, Tate. You know, I also have a kids fitness company and I run kids fitness classes. I've been doing this since 87. And I had a summer class. So in that summer class, it was for the younger child, but the older child who was like 4 years older was in attendance because there was no school. And the mother saying to me, is it all right if whatever his name was joined us? And I'm like, sure, it's fine. It's fine. She spent the entire class telling that child, now don't be pushy and don't do this and don't do that. And, you know, make sure you're not monopolizing your little brother and let him get a chance. This was like heard the whole class. And literally you can tell your husband, I said afterwards, she was like, so he really loved the class. Is it okay for him to come back? And I actually, what I wanted to say, let me preface this with, I did not say this. But what I wanted to say was, yes, absolutely, they can come back. You and your husband, no, you guys cannot come back. Your two children are more than welcome to be here for the rest of the session. But of course, alas, I could not say that. I wanted to, but I could not. So I definitely know where he's coming from.
Yeah, I said one of our running jokes is you know, I was not good at relationships. And I was very protective of myself. And it took me a long time to deal with my shame and the challenges that I had. And I don't think that I ever really truly acknowledged being a gay man and willing to deal with it until I got sober. And so it was a slow process. You know, we have a saying in recovery that you when you stop maturing whenever you become an alcoholic.
And, absolutely.
And that was certainly true for me. And anyway, our running joke is that it took a developmental and behavioral pediatrician to be able to have a relationship with me. Because I had so much growing up to do.
There you go.
It's really true, though. I mean,
there's
really
a person
is.
For each of us. He was your person.
So, but directly answer the question is that yes, it has been a journey, though. I did struggle in relationships. Because it was very fear-based and I didn't like people in my space and I didn't want to depend on people. And it's an unhealthy way to live. And I didn't want to trust people. And really recovery helped me start breaking those walls down a little bit. And frankly, in my drinking days, I would just drink too much to be able to form a relationship. You know, when I finally came out, I still struggled with the idea of being a gay man. And my initial, while I was still drinking, relationship with gay life was I would drink, I would go to the bars, I would try to meet somebody. Usually that was fairly successful. And that was the extent of it. It's like, I'm willing to acknowledge that I have these attractions, but I really don't want any of you gay people as my friends or really in my world. I'm still a man, you know? Yeah. And I had my father's view of gays even after I came out.
Enough. It's amazing how much the mind, you know, stays thinking a certain way until we're willing to, you know, confront these thoughts. So what, and I know we're going long with this podcast, and I appreciate audience, you guys listening, and I know you're fascinated with it all, as I am. What made you enter recovery? So what got you from alcoholic to I need help?
Yeah. I am in the early 90s, I moved from Houston, and a law school buddy of mine began a personal injury and civil rights law practice up in North Texas in Arlington, Dallas, Fort Worth area. And that law practice became successful very, very quickly. You know, you give a poor boy a lot of money, and it's a recipe for chaos, really. But there were no checks and balances on me because I worked for myself, so I drank all the time, and I went from being hyper successful in 95-96 until by early 1998, I stayed drunk all the time. And I started a really bad routine where I would be very shaky in the morning. And I knew two different doctors, and I was in a bad automobile accident, so I had a pain management doctor. And so I was constantly getting Librium, Valium, codeine, and I was mixing that with the alcohol. So I stayed in a daze most of the time. Well, by the time, you know, mid-1998 rolled around, that extremely lucrative, successful law practice was dead. I was in arrears on my house, and I had lost really everything. So I went from straight up to straight down, and I had to move back in with my mom and dad. And my days with my mom and dad were basically drinking nonstop in their garage. And on one particular day, I just woke up on my back on the garage floor, and I had urinated on myself. I had defecated on myself. I was delirious. My head hurt. And I had this flash of, you can't live with alcohol anymore. And then the next flash was, you can't live without it either. And I didn't really know what to do. And I got enough strength to get up and to get out of these clothes and to take a shower. And I grabbed some Jim Beam that was in the house, and I had about 20 Valium in my hand. And I said, you know what? I'm not doing this. I'm worthless, and I'm just not doing this. So I was shaking, and I remember I took a couple of Valium and a swig and said, let me just settle down a minute, you know, before I kill myself, basically. Let me just settle down a minute. And then I had this flash in my head. A buddy of mine named AJ up in North Texas had told me repeatedly he's worried about my drinking. He was also a doctor. And he had told me about Hazelden. And he says, you know, I really wish you'd just call them, Tate. I really wish you'd just call them. And, you know, you're going to do what you're going to do, but I wish you'd call them whenever you're ready. And I thought, and I looked around the house, and I saw my mom had all my trophies from high school debate and all of that stuff. And I saw all these pictures of my sisters who adore me. My sisters, we are like this. So I thought, maybe before you do this, just call. I was convinced, but I said, check that box was what I was thinking. Right. So you can get past it.
Thank goodness.
Get it done. And there was a guy on the phone at Hazelden that answered the phone, named Ted. And Ted kept me on the phone for 2.5 hours. And he was funny. And he says, you know, I'm from Minnesota, but I love wearing Western clothes. Are there a lot of people wearing Western clothes down there? He would say things like, he'd go on these tangents, and I'd try to go with him. And by the time, in 2.5 hours later after this call, I had kind of sobered up. And then Ted says, you know, Tate, I think you should come see us. And I don't have an opening for you to January 8th. And I'm worried about you. Can you think you can not have these thoughts for 8 days? Is there somebody else you can call? So I said, and I didn't have any health insurance at the time, and I was broke. But in a fit of paranoia, when I was back drinking, I had sent 20 grand to a buddy of mine from college. Kind of like, you know, people are going to get me. So here, take this money so I can, you know, get it whenever I need to do. I don't know what I was thinking.
Good thought, though.
Hung up with Ted, yeah, I called my buddy Greg, and he says, I still got that money. And I told him that I had talked to Hazleton and what had happened to me. And he says, I'm going to call you back in an hour and a half. Can you give me an hour and a half? Will you answer an hour and a half? And I said, yeah, Greg. And an hour and a half later, he said, I've talked to Hazleton. Everything's taken care of. You just got to get there on January 8th. I'm about to tear up. I have had so many.
You're making me cry.
I have had so many angels in my life.
That's because you are an angel. So, angels attract angels.
Thank you. And I got on that plane, January 8th. And I've been clean and sober 1999 and clean and sober since. Yeah.
Yay. Oh my gosh. Tate, shame there's a glass between, because I will give you a big, huge hug. This is like so wonderful. And I know you are inspiring, and hopefully somebody is listening to this that is going through a similar situation and is like, you know, thinking I can't do this or I'm going to give up. And that's like a wonderful story. So, you know, I can definitely see, yeah, you and I, excuse me, could go on talking for hours. But like I usually say in my way too long podcast, I'm sure these people have something else to do with their lives. can you, Tate, do you have some advice before we kind of bring this to a close to give a parent who might be suspecting their child is going through what you've gone through, or just found out that their child is gay? Or, you know, because it's also parents have their own little dreams and wishes. And not that these things can't come true if your child's gay, but, you know, we have this traditional, for the most part, view on life that we're going to get married and we're going to have grandchildren and, you know, house with the white fence and a dog and whatever. We have this like imaginary life. And I think some people are instantly like, oh, well, if you're gay, that's not going to happen. Accepting that there can be another lifestyle that also creates such happiness.
And Celia, you hit the nail on the head, because that was what I experienced when I came out with Mom. She said, she started crying and she says, son, I'm just going to have to deal with this in my own way. I always thought you'd get married and have kids because you love kids. And I said, Mom, I your version of happiness and my version of happiness may be different. And that was what I told her. And she just said, you know, it'll just take time for me. And it's been fine. You know, my mother is the light of my life. And it has been fine. But I'm going to be very frank. My mom, when I came out to her, said, you know, your dad and I talked about that you might be gay in high school. And we talked about it a couple of times, that might be a possibility. And at the time, I didn't say, Mom, I wish you would have done this or I wish you would have done that. But let me share this to parents out there. I will tell you this. If my mom, and especially if both my mom and dad would have come to me at that time and said, son, I want you to know that whether you're gay or trans or bisexual or whatever, whatever you may do, whoever you may be, we love you. If they'd have done that, I probably still would have denied it. But I know I would have known that I could have had that conversation because I didn't tell my dad until the time of his final illness. And I know that life likely would not have been as complicated and as burdensome, because when you love your parents, you fear disappointing them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I feared disappointing them because I was gay. So if you please just say, if it's okay, you're gonna love your child, gay or straight, male or female, transitioning, not transitioning, we're going to love you. I can tell you, it will make a world of difference. And when I say a world of difference, I mean a world of difference in terms of there is nothing like knowing you are loved that helps. It helps absolutely everything.
Absolutely. Love your child unconditionally. You know, that's, you know, even with, you know, and I've talked about, because people ask me why I'm so passionate about parents yelling at their kid, or I should say parents not yelling at their kids, and why that is so, I'm so passionate about it. And when I say my dad was the yeller in the family, I don't say that meaning I didn't think he loved us. I guarantee you, of us four kids, there isn't one of us that did not know through and through that that man had our back no matter what. No matter what we were going through, he was on our side. Always. And we always knew that. What is so devastating, his incredible achievements for mankind and how little he thought of himself because of the abuse he suffered as a child. And that's the point I try to make to others in the yelling and the aggressive behavior, is that you are destroying your child's confidence and their belief in themselves. And your child will always want to make you proud. They will love you even if you're the worst parent in the world. But what happens is they grow up hating themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's a terrible place to be. And at some point, you grow up hating yourself until, thank goodness, God, the universe, whoever intervened, whoever wants to say who it was that intervened with you, intervened, because Tate, what a blessing you are to mankind. And you are just, I am so honored to have met you. And I'm really emotional with this podcast. That's all right. I'm an emotional people. You're now my best friend. So
you're mine. It's been a delightful experience with
I'm
you.
So, really, I'm so grateful you're on this planet.
I'm coming to Maryland.
So that's okay, good. We're setting up a time. We're gonna hey, me gotta get your crab cakes. It'll be delicious. All right. Now, okay. So all of you guys, thank you for being with us. I know however long this has been, almost an hour. I know your time is valuable, and I can speak for Tate to say that we are both grateful that you took some time out of your busy life to spend some time listening to us. Tate, before we go, can you please tell them about your book? I know it comes out September 25th, right?
We published,
which is one day before both my children's birthday. My son is September 26th and my daughter is September 27th. They are 6 years apart, but basically I'm only fertile one day a year. So catch me on that day, I'm good to go. But tell them how they can reach you, please.
Sure. You can certainly, there's an excerpt of the book, a couple of excerpts of the book available at TateBarkley.com. And you can download an excerpt and read it. The book becomes available on Bookshop if you prefer to purchase it from independent lit sources. It's available on Amazon.com, publication September 25th. And you can follow me at Barkley.Tate at Instagram, Tate Barkley, Facebook, and of course, TateBarkley.com. And it was a joy to be here today.
Oh, such a pleasure, Tate. I'm telling you, best friends. Okay, so We will not end our communication with each other at the end of this podcast. I plan to keep in touch. All right. To all of you listening, once again, thank you for being here. If this helped you and you know somebody that it can help, that will really benefit from listening to this conversation, please, please, please share this out. Share the love. That's how we help heal each other. And to all of you, I wish you days filled with peace, love, and tons of laughter. Really is the best medicine. See, we could laugh about this. We're laughing in the podcast. You know, stuff is funny. There's funny. Find your funny. And I'll see you here next time on the Pumped Up Parenting Podcast. Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you for listening to the Pumped Up Parenting Podcast. If you're really ready to start creating cooperation in your home, more listening, more joy, less stress, less yelling, less negotiating, a whole lot less aggravation, then reach out to me and let's put a parenting system in place that works for you and your kids. Private and group coaching is available, and in 6 months or less, you will start seeing a much happier home that your children will blossom from instead of have to recover from. Get the manual that I wrote for your parenting journey, Raising Happy Toddlers, How to Build Great Parenting Skills, and Stop Yelling at Your Kids, along with my 3 children's books, All About Me, I Am Grateful, and Being Different is Fun. Find it all at pumpedupparenting.com.